What's up, everybody? Welcome to We Have Cool Friends, the cool show. We interview our cool friends about the cool things they're doing. I'm Greg, and this is my cool friend, Rahul Kohli. Hello, Rahul.
Hey, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. Cool friend.
Yeah. How's that sit with you? You like that?
I've always wanted to be cool.
Yeah? You've always been cool. I think it's worth pointing out. I had to go back into the archives, look for your last appearances on Kinda Funny. You were on Game Over Greggy, episode 124, April 22nd, 2016. Then you returned at Game Over Greggy 192, August 11th, 2017. And I don't think we've had you proper on a show since then. We've done the phone call things. Where I remember when we were doing
the
Knights and Bikes. Yeah, the in it. And you're like, no, you're putting an extra thing in there.
Dude, that's one of my favorite little clips. But sure, you know, when you amass stuff, like that whole cover. I think I was driving to Comic Con. Is that time out?
Probably. I think so.
Yeah, I was on my car and you called while I was driving. It's been a while because I think what we used to time for us was I would always drive to Vancouver.
Yeah.
For iZombie, or I was driving back. And obviously I would try and pass through San Fran to hang out with you guys.
You helped us stuff posters into Tube once for Patreon. That was I mean, your first appearance. We had like a mountain of posters you helped us stuff.
But now I take private jets, so
I know that's the thing. You know, back in the day you were this young scrappy artist, you know what I mean? You were I'll never forget that Comic-Con working at IGN. You were doing the tour for iZombie's pilot, right? And you walked by the stage and we just ended and you ran over. You're like, "Beyond, I'm a huge fan. I'm doing this thing. It's called iZombie. I don't know if I'll ever see you again. Bye." And then here we are. I was like, "I'll never hear from this guy again." No one's going to watch that show. That comic book thing, never going to take off.
See, that story goes against saying that you have cool friends.
Well, no, once I figured out you were cool, you know what I mean? That was the thing. Because if you remember, we didn't invite you on any of the shows right away then. It was we had to wait for, of course, iZombie became a success. Then we were like, okay, now bring them on stuff.
That's true. Yeah. I do remember the first one. Yeah, that was awesome.
So, but yeah, now how does it feel right now to have the world by the balls? I follow you on Twitter. I see everybody putting up these things of how much they want to have sex with Owen from Bly Manor. That's you right now. How's that feel, huh?
Ridiculous. Like, when we were doing it, the mustache was always came up in conversation, right? And I committed to a look that I thought was appropriate for the time and Owen's race. You know, I was looking at pictures of like dad and my uncles. Yeah. They all had these porn star mustaches and, you know, they all tried to look like Tom Selleck. And when I asked for that, it just looked ridiculous. And I think everyone was like, it's distracting, it's stupid. And there were a few people that were like, no, I think the internet are going to like it when it comes out. But to be thirsted over when I'm playing a character that is not, how do I put this? I don't look my best. It's the internet be funny. You can never predict what hits, really. But I love the attention.
Oh, I know you love the attention. You're an attention whore. Look at you. That's why you got into acting. You know what I mean? I see you out there. But I think that's what's been so funny about it. It's the funny side of the people thirsting after you and you constantly using that gift of Christ. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's your response to everything, right? But I've also enjoyed your retweets. And this is obviously in the heat of Bly when it dropped on that first weekend. And of course, if you don't know, Bly Manor is the new Mike Flanagan horror show over on Netflix and stuff. It's been raging out through October. Everybody loves it. But it was the people you were retweeting that were thanking you for representing basically their father and what he looked like in the 90s and what that style was.
Yeah. Yeah. And that felt super, that felt good because like I said, I think it was just like going to be how I sort of normally look. We would have just been wearing 80s clothes, but I was like, no, I saw pictures of dad in 1987 and this is the look. And then to get sent pictures of people's parents and uncles from that time, I was like, nailed it. Like it felt good. I had a mustache I think you saw me at the Game Awards and I was still rocking it at one point.
Yeah,
So all my photos, it ruined my Obi-Wan cosplay for my birthday because I had the big Biggs mustache, but it was worth it when I saw how people kind of reacted to it.
Now, there's so much to tackle with you because we obviously have caught up at Game Awards, a few other places, but we haven't had a sit-down podcast conversation in forever. So let me get the housekeeping out of the way. If you didn't know, ladies and gentlemen, this is We Have Cool Friends. It's Kind of Funny's interview podcast. It posts every Tuesday on youtube.com/kindoffunny, podcast services around the globe. And of course, you can go to patreon.com/kindoffunny to get it ad-free and get it with your questions inserted. You can go ahead and get into the friend zone and ask questions of people like Rahul. Of course, it's worth pointing out, thank you to our Patreon producer Mohammed at Kind of Funny, patreon.com/kindoffunny. Mohammed produced us over there. And of course, I want to thank our sponsors, MeUndies and Blue Chew, but I'll tell you about that later. Rahul, you get it more than most, right? The internet friendship and the fact that you and I go off, we do our different things, but we see each other online. Occasionally there's a crank phone call. It's all that way. We're up on each other's lives. Mm-hmm. Today, as of recording, you posted this tweet. Just found out today that I may be able to return home after not being able to enter the USA since June. All I've been doing today is looking at pictures of my apartment and thinking about sleeping in my own bed. I miss my bidet. My anus does too. Loudly crying face. Mm-hmm. I had completely missed that you are stranded somewhere else. Where are you? What's happening?
Yeah, I didn't really talk about it because I'll be honest with you, it's still first world problems and it's not a time to jump on your soapbox during a pandemic and be like, hey, you know, so what happened was, I'm British, so I have a visa for the US. Yeah. And while I was doing Bly, my US visa expired. Nothing serious, just had to be due. It was due for renewal.
Where was Bly filming?
Bly was filming in Vancouver.
Okay.
So during that time, when we were getting close to the renewal process, we had decided as a team that, because I was going straight onto Midnight Mass, I think Midnight Mass at the time, I was going to have 2 weeks off to get into character and then start Midnight Mass. They were like, well, you're going to be up in Vancouver for 6 months, 7 months. Do you want to start this process now or do you want to wait until you're closer to coming home again? And I was like, yeah, sure, that makes sense to me. Like I can still go back to my apartment in LA as a tourist because I can still go back and forth.
Yeah.
So we were like, great, good plan. And then pandemic. Yeah, so we were 1 day away from filming Midnight Mass.
And Midnight Mass is the new Mike Flanagan thing.
It's the new Mike Flanagan thing, which he offered me while I was working on Bly.
And we'll get into that too. This whole Bly Manor thing, you're into this whole, like, you're like the Brat Pack now. These people just getting, you know what I mean? Get me in there. Get me in the background as a ghost. I'll be there, dick out. I don't care what they need from me. Yeah.
We should get you as a ghost hunter. Maybe a ghost.
Spirit Buster. Well,
Spirit Buster.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so we were a day from shooting and everything went into lock and we were told, hey, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Go home. And so I managed to get on a flight to LA as a tourist because the lockdown wasn't like proper strict at the time. Yeah. And then I was on a 90-day countdown because I was like, oh shit, I have to leave or I'm going to be deported. And that's what happened. So the day before I was going to be deported, I got on a plane as quick as I could to London because that's the only place I have any type of citizenship.
Residency, yeah.
Yeah. So I was then essentially stranded. Couldn't go back to my apartment. There was no chance of me ever getting back. They weren't taking any type of, no visas and stuff were being spoken about. And the current administration was then stripping back work visas all over the place. So it was a complete mess. And then luckily we, with lawyers and stuff, we managed to sort that out recently. But then the newest problem was the embassies over here aren't open. So you couldn't, even though I've been approved, I can't physically get one because I can't go to it. It's the small, easy part, which is, can you just put this in my passport? That bit's been dead for months. But then I got news yesterday that we may have an appointment. So that's why I got very home. I was like, holy crap. Okay. I might be going home at some point because the other option was we would wrap filming in December and I would either have to go back to London, which I don't live in. I would just be staying at my parents' house indefinitely, or I would be staying out here for as long as I could.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. So it's been a little bit of an issue.
So now how does that all play into then working in general? You're back in Vancouver. Are you already back on sets? Is it the whole we're taking your temperature and like all these crazy checks and stuff?
Yeah. So we Netflix and SAG and the Canadian government figured out a guideline. So we were one of the first shows to try this out. Okay, well, can we do this in a COVID world? And so we started production a few months back, and it took that long for them to kind of figure out those rules, like PPE and when do you take it off and how do we do this and how do we do makeup. So once they got all that done, we came to
set. They haven't done this in forever. The sirens are on our end, everybody. That's not a cop car behind you.
That is a fire truck. It's gone. Yeah, I don't know what's going on. But yeah, so we had to. It took a week or two to get used to it. It's odd. Sure. I get, you know, COVID tested constantly, and then when I'm not, it's like the athletes. Like when I'm not out on set, I'm in a bubble. I don't leave the apartment. But we're getting through it, and it's been super safe, and we've had no issues. So we're sort of a blueprint. So if we can do it and these rules work, then more shows will probably follow that same guideline. Yeah.
Is it extending the shoot? I'm not an entertainment reporter. I'm not trying to pry here at all. But like, are all the steps making days longer in a different way? And so is it a longer shoot, or is it pretty normal?
I feel like it's quicker.
Oh wow.
I think what's happened is they've had to strip a lot of the extra business we used to have, and now it's like you just move. So I do feel like we're moving through it faster for some strange reason. And there's it's kind of a more kind of condensed set now, because of social distancing. We're only called when we absolutely need to be there, because they don't want too many people flooding set. And as the actors, we have to be the most protective. So yeah, it's actually kind of more efficient. The only thing that's inefficient is you go in the hair and makeup trailer, which is completely PPE'd up and stuff. They do a great job of your makeup and your beard and your hair, and then you immediately stick a face shield on and a mask.
Yeah.
And then you sit in that for an hour, and then half of it's inside your N95. That's the only thing that's inefficient that makes sense. But other than that, everything's been pretty smooth.
So we've caught up to the present here. Talk to me about since we last did a show together. Obviously, you were in the throes of iZombie then.
Yeah.
And since then, the show's ended right after what? It was five seasons, four seasons?
We did five seasons. Yeah. I think I saw you when we were starting season four, maybe.
Yeah.
Something like that. But that came and went. And I was lucky in between. It's quite difficult to work on other projects when you're locked into a network show.
Sure.
But I benefited from being able to do Gears.
Yeah.
So that was Gears a little fun. Something that I got to do. Yeah. And then I also got to do the best one was that I got to sneak in at the time, which we hadn't spoken about, was Harley Quinn.
Yeah. Scarecrow.
Yeah. That was such an awesome little thing I did, because the creators of that show, Dean, Justin and Patrick, they had worked on iZombie for a season or so, and we got on really well, and they liked my comedic role in the show. And at one point, I think they hit me up and they were like, would you audition for Riddler for us? So I did. And then I never heard back for about a month. And then I got another email that was like, we're thinking Cockney Scarecrow. Are you interested? Can you give us an audition? So I still had to audition, and I submitted my tape, and then I got to do that. And when I first read the pilot and the first few, I hit him up and I was like, yo, this is Rick and Morty good.
Yeah.
This is one of the first times in my career I'd read something. And I was like, oh, I'm on a hit. This is huge. It's so funny. And it's still to date one of the most fun. It's the most fun I've had, especially in a recording studio. That was super good.
Yeah. At the time, obviously, I think that's what we talked about mainly at the Game Awards, but like, yeah, it was the idea that like so many people were sleeping on Harley Quinn, the animated series, right? Because it was over on, you know, DC Universe or whatever. So there's the apps and stuff like that to jump through. But now that it's HBO Max and everywhere else, it's like, yeah, you have to get on that.
Yeah. And I think now it's also on like, it came to the UK. So it's on UK TV and things like that. So I've been seeing a lot more kind of engagement where Harley Quinn's concerned. A lot of people don't even know it's me, which is fun. But it also is the first time as well. Like, even though I've done iZombie and some other stuff, being at work, usually you work with these wonderful people whose projects you've seen or you're a fan of. And I usually gush over my co-stars and I'm like, oh shit, you were on Battlestar Galactica. And Harley Quinn was the first time that like Mike had come up to me and Kate, and they had been watching it, and I got a credit where someone was like, Harley Quinn's amazing. So they gave me this, the first respect of my peers sort of thing. I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, that's a, it was a great show. But yeah, and now that it's not on, well, now that it's, yeah, HBO Max and stuff, like it's been definitely getting a lot more views.
So when you're getting ready to end iZombie, and you're talking about, you know, obviously being on a show that goes on and on, right? That there's less for you to get out and branch out. Is there that, what were your, I guess, levels between excitement and it was there fear? Like, I would feel like if I was on a show for in a completely different world on for seasons, when that's getting ready to wrap up, there would be that thing of like, well, what do I do for money? Like, will there still be opportunities out there?
It was both of those things. There was definitely a kind of in a turmoil there. I think when I got to our fifth season, I thoroughly enjoyed making season four. When we got to our fifth, I definitely felt burnt out little bit. And I think I reached my limit of interest. And I was like, wow, okay. And so did everyone else, I think. So, and that's fair, I think. And Rob knows that. So Rob was very much like, five and we're out. And I think we've told our story. So throughout that, I was very excited to start working on other projects, playing other characters, and just sort of like, yeah, enjoying all that comes with that and that freedom of, you know, shows that all shoot at the exact same time, unfortunately. So when you're locked into one, you're effectively out of the game, pretty much for most of the year. So that was exciting. But at the same time, the inner voice in me was like, you're a one-hit wonder, even though it wasn't even that much of a hit. Like, can lightning strike twice? Are you, what is the future? Is it a couple of guest roles here and you're done? And so it was tough, and it was my first ever pilot. And because I booked iZombie, it was Fluke. It was a tape sent from London. And that was it. And usually that comes when you do a network show, there's like so many levels. You have to audition multiple times, and then you have a director session, then you have a network session, and they really put you through your paces to kind of get this pilot cast together. And I negated all of that because Rob liked my tape so much. I auditioned on Monday, and Friday I was signing the contract. There was nothing in between that. Yeah. And all my castmates, Mac, Rose, everyone had to go through the same process. So I just immediately, and that was, I never even done pilot season. So I was in, and then for 5 years, I kept hearing about how terrible pilot season is. So there was this like, there was this worry when I was like, oh shit, this is going to be it. This is me getting put through my paces. And I actually booked a pilot immediately, but I declined it. I wasn't interested in it. And it was financially, it was super rewarding, but I wasn't interested in it at all. It was a character I didn't want to play. And I had this fear because I did it not having a job, not really having much money. And I was like, oh crap, I'm turning down payloads now because I don't like the creative side. Like I'm going to be that dude. I'm not going to sell out and just go.
You're in it for the art.
And I kind of, it made me feel sick slightly because I was like, as I turned this down and they were like, no, we hadn't, they thought I was playing hardball. So they were like, how about that, this much money? Well, how about this much money? How about more creative control? And I was like, no, I don't believe in the project. I'm not interested. And it scared the living crap out of me that I was doing that because I was like, well, I'm destined to be, you know, I'm not going to work very often, it looks like, and I'm not going to get paid very often. And then somewhere around, so I passed, and that was my pilot season done. And then I think I was just back home in August in London for a vacation to see my folks, and I got an audition for Bly, for The Haunting. And my mum had to double as my scene partner. My mum doesn't act; she's never done it before. So,
but she got cast too.
Dude, they loved her. I had no idea. The thing is, I didn't know because like all of these things are surrounded by secrecy, right?
Sure.
I didn't know that Owen and his mum were going to have this thing, right? Mm. Like that wasn't in the brief. And
by the way, too, I want to put this out there early. Full spoilers for Bly Manor on this episode.
Okay. We'll go.
So if you haven't watched it, like you pause this episode, go watch Bly Manor. It's great.
Yeah. So I didn't realize that I effectively was strengthening my chances by reading with my mum. And apparently, because I had cut outtakes, because Mum was terrible. She was awful. She was
all right. Let's not be too harsh, all right? I saw you on Supergirl. You don't have stones to throw.
That's fair. But yeah, so like, you know, she was doing stuff on the tape, man, where she was mouthing my lines. If I got it right, she'd throw a thumbs up. And I was like, what are you doing? Stop it. You don't need to do that. And I cut together a little clip of all of the times we goofed. And I put it on Insta. And this is before I booked the job. But apparently Netflix and Paramount had seen that. And they were like, oh, we love this. And I think that might have helped me book it more than the freaking audition itself.
Wow.
And then that put me with Mike, which led to Midnight Mass. So they all happened in the same year of Leaving Eye Zombie. So I've been very fortunate. And I got to do it my way. I held it. Because if I'd taken that money job for the show I didn't want, for the character I didn't want to play, I would have been effectively locked out of ever doing The Haunting, which wouldn't have led to Midnight Mass, which is arguably, right now, I think it's the best thing I've ever read.
Holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
See, and this is what I'm talking about. Now you're in this clique. There's the clique for the voice actors, right? You're Troy Baker, Laura, Travis. One of them gets hired. Curly. No, not yet. One of them gets hired. They bring in the rest. Now you're in this Bly thing, because that was the thing of watching, you know, Hill House and loving Hill House to start Bly. And first off, hearing about it in general, I was like, I'm gonna watch it. Don't worry about it. And then even when you were tweeting about it or Instagramming about it, I would stay away from it. I wanted to come in sight unseen. And so to come in and then be like, wait, it's the same. Oh, it's like this, you know, ensemble. It's like this traveling theater company that's gonna put on this one as well. And then to see you now, at least. I'm speaking from an outsider, to see you in this Flanagan theater troupe now setting off to do the next one. That's a really cool thing to see, like what you're talking about, I think, where if you're going to pass on something because you're not into the creative of it, for you to fall in with a bunch of other creatives and creators and be on the same page and want to keep doing stuff together, I assume that's got to be a great feeling for you as an actor.
Oh, yeah, massively. I mean, Mike, it's not so much just a haunting thing, I think. Where Mike is concerned, and we're still very early on in our friendship relationships, I'm still learning about him and the way he likes to work and what sort of has happened in his past that has informed the way that he likes to conduct his sets and cast people. I think Mike is someone who has had a long kind of tough journey where being a filmmaker has been concerned. And what seems apparent with Mike is that once he trusts you and feels like he can, you know, you can deliver the goods, he wants you. You bring a certain level of stability now. And that carries over. So like Henry Thomas, who played Wingrave in yeah. our, and all has obviously, he's been in about three or four different stuff. He was in Dr. Sleep. It's because not only does Mike have an affection for him and he's incredibly talented, it's also because—
Wait, time out. Did Mike Flanagan do Dr. Sleep?
Yeah.
Oh, I just watched that last night and I was like, oh, yeah. that's the guy from Bly Manor. That makes more sense now. Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Mike did Dr. Sleep between Hill House and Bly.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So obviously when I had my first meeting with Mike, I was like, what's Ewan McGregor like?
tell me all the Star Wars stories he told you.
Exactly. Didn't talk about Owen whatsoever. I was just like, so is McGregor cool? Like, but yeah, so Mike definitely likes to have a certain amount of actors in his arsenal that he just trusts. Obviously, he still casts and finds unknowns and does stuff, but it's a very in a kind of world where even at your top of your game, it could be over tomorrow, right? Like we've seen that countless times of actors who are just in leads in movies and then they just disappear and that's it,
yeah.
And no one knows why the phone stops ringing. To have people like Mike Flanagan and Rob Thomas is very much the same. It's the same sort of thing where Rob likes to use the same people. To have that in two of my showrunner daddies is massively. It makes me feel good, obviously, and it's an honor to work with them. And it means hopefully, you know, if things do go sideways and I really do fuck all this up, there'll still be a job for me maybe on one of their shows again. So, yeah.
Do you know, you talk about doing five seasons of Eye Zombie and be like, that's enough. That's time for me to move on.
Yeah.
I know I'm getting ahead of myself, you know, cart in front of the horse. with this kind of project, and again, the same cast of actors coming together and creatives coming together to make this, would that get around it for you? Or even there, could you see yourself if they approached you for a fifth or sixth horror thing in the Mike Flanagan anthology series, would you be like, I got to go do a rom-com. I want to branch out and do something different.
I think the issue with iZombie wasn't, I would have worked again with Rob on his next show immediately within a week, because I love Rob Thomas and I owe him so much. As long as, for me, where Mike's concerned and whatever future projects are aligned, as long as I feel that I am playing something different, then that scratches that itch. You know, like if I was playing Ravi again and again and again and again, I think then obviously I'd get tired of it. It's not so much working with the people. It's not the people I tire of. It's when you feel like you're just doing it now, and it's like I've played it. Like what? Sure. What else is out there? And iZombie was good because they gave me brains in 4 and 5 to start doing these personalities, which allowed me to have a little bit more fun and branch out and get dialect coaching for a Russian accent and learn this.
Do something different, right? I feel like that's got to be the fun part that you're talking about is, you're Ravi, awesome. You're going to be him for 22 episodes. Okay, that's a lot. And then by the time you get to season 3, it's like, well, what else can I do with this guy? I know this guy.
Yeah, exactly. And I enjoyed playing him up until the very end, but there was definitely this like, oh, I want to do some other stuff. And where Mike's concerned right now, my character on Midnight Mass is massively different from my character on Bly. So I'm getting the best of both worlds. I get to work with someone I trust and have a massive amount of respect for, and I get to play something completely different. He hasn't gone, you did that well, do that again. It's like, you did that well, we think you could do this. And that relationship is something that if I only work with Mike for the next decade, I wouldn't be complaining. I know he'll still put me through my paces and challenge me.
So then, we talked about, you know, you doing the audition, the tape audition with your mom for Bly. Do you know at that time that it's for Bly? Do you know it's a Netflix horror thing? Like, how does that get set up for you?
I did. I knew it was called Hill House Season 2.
Gotcha.
And it gave a brief synopsis of the story. And it was mainly about, actually, the synopsis wasn't even particularly detailed. It was more adaptation of Henry James's Turn of the Screw. So that's as much as I knew. And they said Owen is like sweet guy, comes back to town and he's a chef. So that's as much as I sort of had. And then everything else I had to kind of like extrapolate from the dialogue that we had that was in the scene to know who I was playing. But outside of that, that's all you really get. You don't get any full scripts. You don't get to read a first episode. And that's super common. I mean, I've done auditions where like, and I guess I can talk about it now. Like, I've done auditions for like, Tenant.
Okay.
And Nolan's Tenant. And with that, that audition was Nolan's next film. Didn't have a title, didn't have a release, didn't have a synopsis, didn't have a character name, didn't have a character synopsis, and the sides were fake. So the script wasn't even the script. Beautiful. It was just a monologue that they had sent out to actors. So that's when you get into that super, you don't even know what the hell you're doing. It could have been, yeah. So it is a shame sometimes, but also it works to your benefit. I think sometimes if you know what you're going for, you could add too much pressure to yourself.
And that was the question I was going towards is, yeah, like both for now, this for Tenant and then to talk about Bly, are you able to check that at the door? And I don't even know if it was for you, like being such a fan of Hill House, if I would have been like, you want to be in the next one? I would have been like, holy fuck. Like that would have fucked with me. Now, granted, I'm not a professionally trained actor, nor do I audition for anything. So of course they'd be like, you want to be in the Lucky Charms commercial? I'd be like, oh my fucking God, I could be lucky. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, like I'm going to freak out about it. But like, are at this point in your career, can you check all that? Like you put it aside?
I had to, and I did it. I put that aside years ago. When I left drama school and I first started getting auditions, the things I were going for, I would obsess over, and it's if it was, I remember going for like even TV dramas that I knew had actors that I liked, and they weren't necessarily big, but I was like, oh my God, if I get this, this is the start of my career. And it would, it would take so long to get it. It wasn't so much that it would affect how I performed my audition. I think I would always bring my A game as best I could. What it was doing to me was it was crushing me when I wasn't getting callbacks. Mm. And because I'd already fantasized about it, I'd already casted myself. I thought that
you're
this
on
one
season was- three, right? Yeah, yeah,
exactly. You're- right. And I'm doing this as a 24-year-old, 23-year-old. And so it, what was happening was I was just getting crushed every time. I thought I nailed that, and then I didn't, and I didn't get a callback. So it got beaten out of me by the time I was on iZombie. I didn't care. Even when iZombie came along and they were like, pilot, DC comic, DC Vertigo comic, I was like, yeah, all right, cool. And it's not that I was too cool for it. It's just that by that point of 8 years of rejection, you go, heard it all before. I've been up for 24. I've been up for this movie. I've been up for, you know, whatever. And I don't get callbacks. So why am I going to get excited about this? I won't get excited until the contract signed. And that's still, and now that I'm in a world where the things that I'm auditioning for are huge, they're all stuff that will, if I booked, will take you straight to like the A-list, and they'll like, you know, you're going to be financially set for life. They come along a lot more frequently now. Still don't book them.
You had Gears.
That's true. And my life has changed from Gears. I don't have a tattoo. It's just to protect myself now at this point. I found the right balance of being enthusiastic and fired up enough about the project that I can do a good tape or be motivated to get this audition done, even if I'm on set and I'm working, but not forget about it the second I email that tape off. I'm like, whatever.
Sure. Yeah. What happens is going to happen.
Yeah. So I didn't, when Bly came along, oh shit, Hill House, that's dope. Mike Flanagan, cool. And then I just switch off and don't care. And then when it came around and I got the call that I was cast, then all of the fantasizing and the, oh my God, horror, this, and all of the excitement comes.
So then walk me through, I guess, getting into character as Owen, because I think that's what's so fascinating, is obviously having known you for so long and being able to call you a friend, like watching you up there, there's so many moments where I'm like, oh, this, it is so Rahul already. Like, you know what I mean? And a lot of just the lame jokes and how you are, but then like the honesty that he carries into those conversations. And I tweeted it at you as I talked to you, like, right, of like, you fucking crush that, dude. You crush this performance and this character to the point of like, when you're crying at the bonfire, like when that episode ends, like Jen and I both looked at you like, holy shit, Rahul. You know what I mean? Of like, fuck, to be on that ride. And then like for, you know, the conversation with Mrs. Gross over and over and over again, and the way you change and do it. And it's not Owen, but it is Owen, and the way you own that. And then even at the end, right? When it's such a fascinating thing that I would think if I was, you know, sight unseen coming into it, it would have been something that you knew this character for years, when in reality you didn't, right? You just got into the place of knowing him. And the way you work as an ensemble with these people, even to talk about this being like, you know, this traveling band of actors, but this is your first time with them in this regard. Like, how does that camaraderie happen? How do you get that deep with that character? Like, how do you find all that?
Well, firstly, thanks, man. That means a lot to me. I didn't think about any of that, really. It's when we were creating the character, I don't do anything. I try my best, and it's very tempting, because especially as you start gaining other people's respect for what you do, they start giving you the world a little bit, and it's kind of like they give you too much rope to hang yourself with.
Sure.
Because if I do want to change something, they will listen, and I can start manipulating a character to play things in my own wheelhouse. If I want to make him a bad boy, I can, because I really want to play it. Like, you can,
you are a bad boy. I've been saying it for a long time. You are Hollywood's bad boy.
It's been known, but like, it's the, I've been doing this exercise with myself, which is remembering and this sounds really like cliched and this sounds like really cliched and stuff, but like, I'm there to serve the story. I'm not there to serve myself. I'm not there to like, it's not a vanity role, and you're just a player. You're there to tell a story. So when Owen came along, as much as I felt that there were similarities to Ravi in terms of his energy and positivity and playing kind of like that light, soft center of the show. And as much as I would like to have manipulated the character to be something I wanted to play, I was like, no, do your job. Just do your fucking job. Don't complicate it. You're supposed to be there for a very specific reason. You bring levity to the show. You're a safe space. That kitchen's a safe space. Don't just be pure with it. Just support your cast members. It's not about you. And that was something that I kept saying to myself over and over again, was this ain't about you. The scene ain't about you. Don't distract. This is about Flora. This is about Amelia. This is about this. This is about Hannah. This is, you know, and it wasn't the most rewarding experience. I didn't leave every day high-fiving the crew going, fucking nailed it. Like, it wasn't... Ravi was a lot like that because he was a show-off character, you know? And I got all the good jokes. And then I came to this show and I really was just very quiet and just did what was asked of me and just developed normal... Like, I was had a very good relationship with the actors who played Miles and Flora, Ben and Amelie. And we were just... play thumb wars between takes and then a lot of the cast were UK based and I had not worked with a lot of British actors before. I'm usually the only Brit. And so we already had a camaraderie because I was just excited. I was like, oh shit, we drink the same tea and we get the same references. So that's where that connection came from. But in terms of the character, I just did what I was told. That's all. Like, Mike wanted, that's what Mike wanted and I wasn't, you know, I'm not above myself to think that like, well, no, actually, I think I can bring this. And like, I was like, no, I'll do, tell me what you want. What do you want? This is what you want. This is what I'll do. And the same, and it seems to have paid off because like I said, I shot very quietly. I don't think I left feeling like I did a good job. I just was like, okay, that was Owen. And then I'd get messages from Mike now and again. And obviously when we were working on Midnight Mass, he'd be like, you're going to be happy. Your monologue came out really well. And this came out. And I'd be like, all right, thanks. I just didn't think about it. I was like, I was just a support guy. And then the reaction afterwards from the critics and stuff, I wasn't expected to be singled out for stuff. And I was. So I learned a lesson. I was kind of rewarded for being a team player and just doing what you're told. And it's sometimes, especially at this point now, it's easy to get everything you want, make it about you, carry that vanity. I don't want to look this way because I don't look handsome enough. It's easy to get into that world. And me, for some reason, rejecting all of that and treating it like, you know, still like the same hired hand I was 6, 7, 8 years ago, seems to have worked. So that's kind of a thing I'm carrying into Midnight Mass and future projects. Just do your job.
Yeah. It sounds easy, right? But I mean, I think as you're talking about it, there's so many different ways you can fuck that up. Where if, absolutely, you think too hard and you want to make a change, and then, yeah, it's something that, a little thing that goes a long way. Because I think that is the thing where you're talking about being the safe space for the characters. Like, that is why I think you're so beloved in the show, or Owen is so beloved in the show, because the audience feels that. And again, that conversation in the kitchen, the job interview over and over again, like, yeah, when that first starts going south, that's why it's so off-putting and it is so weird. And to see, you know, you go through, or Owen go through everything with his mother, right? Like, we're already, yeah, in his corner, we're already in his camp. So to see it all fall apart the way it falls apart for him.
For sure, yeah. Heartbreaking. Absolutely, because you wouldn't give a shit when that stuff happens to him. It wouldn't hit if it wasn't like, if you didn't hit the ground running with that character, if you didn't establish straight away that he's safe and sweet and good things, you know, only good things should happen to him. And he's a genuine guy. Then when the mum stuff happens, no one would care because they wouldn't have had an attachment to him this early on, but luckily they did. And I think the humor sold that and the kind of like levity that he brought to the house. And then the same happened when we did that interview scene. We shot that all in one day. And it wasn't like we rehearsed it or anything. The first day we spoke about it was the day we were shooting them. And Tania and I, and Tania is just standout of that show. She's incredible. Plays Hannah
Grace. She's great.
She, we sat there and we're making decisions on the fly. Like, how much is, what's the closest to the real interview that happened? What's the closest to Owen and Hannah in that moment? Okay, cool. That's our blueprint. That's our foundation. And once that was established, we started to like fuck with that and deconstruct it and decide, well, how much now is Hannah? How much is, and then there was points where I literally would take off the costume and let go of the character's physicality and then put it back on. And these were things we were just doing on the fly, and it was super rewarding. But again, none of it would have worked if you hadn't established very early on who this person was and what they were about. Otherwise you wouldn't, there's nothing to take off. There's no Clark Kent Superman moment. You don't know who the hell either of them are. So why would you give a shit? There needs to be strong outlines. But a lot of the stuff, man, I have to kind of like go back to Rob Thomas. You know, iZombie came from lessons learned from Rob. I mean, to have him as my first showrunner, like, I remember I used to ask for stuff come season 3 and 4. I'd be like, yo, can my character have this now? And I'd get these emails from him going, is this for you or for the character? And it was super like honest and raw. And I'd be like, I think I'm asking because I want it. And I don't know if I'm doing it because I want the character. If it serves the character, it might be just serving Rahul. And I'd have to, any change I made to Ravi, despite owning that character and knowing that I was crushing it and they were happy with it, I never had ownership over him, because anytime I wanted to submit something and say, hey, Rob, I was thinking, is it cool if Ravi does this? I'd get asked, is this a Rahul thing or is this a Ravi thing? And I had to justify every single change to the story. Yeah. And having someone like that, same went with changing dialogue. Like, unless it was a Britishism and I was like, we as Brits don't say this. If I asked Rob to change something, and this is someone who I have deep affection for and who loved me and treated me very well, even with that, I couldn't even change certain things. Like, Rob had this very specific way. And it sounded tough at the time and harsh. You're like, so I can't even fucking change this line of dialogue? and the answer is no. It's no, you can't. Do it. Do it on the page. Make the page work. Going through that was like working with Mr. Miyagi, because I was like frustrated and I was like, what, man? Like, I see on other shows, I went on Supergirl, I was allowed to do whatever the hell I wanted. And then when I got out, I realized I had picked up really good habits. So when Mike was like, hey, if there's anything you want to change, then let's have a discussion. I was like, I'm good. I'm happy to make it work exactly how you want. And all of that stuff came from Rob. So a lot of the Owen stuff that I did just came from how I kind of, my relationship with Rob and how I had to justify everything. It had to be justified. Even though Mike didn't impose that, that's now what I learned.
So. Sure, that's how you, your framework for the work and how you're going to go through and do it. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
exactly.
And I imagine that that is what leads, you're talking about, you know, actors who disappear, you know, they're the biggest thing one day and then don't get a job another time, right? I imagine part of that is in there, right? Because it is, and I'm totally talking as somebody who, you know, watches Entertainment Tonight or whatever, not as somebody in the entertainment industry, but it is that idea that like everybody I talk to, and granted, I talk to my cool friends about this stuff, is in this because they love the process and they love the work. And I imagine if somebody comes in and doesn't respect that and doesn't want to be a part of that and wants to do their own thing and not follow the direction or the writing, then that's, why would you ever want to work with that person again?
Absolutely. I think you get to a point, right, where in the industry where doing the job and having the tools necessary to do that job and do it to a certain high degree, that's now a given. The people I'm going up against, the cast that I work with in this world, they're in that small percentage of actors who are working. And sure, they're there. So talent becomes, who cares? He's talented. She's talented. They're talented. Like, that doesn't have any weight anymore. Now everyone's supposed to be, because you're at the top of your game and you're working with people at the top of their game. When people stop working, it's usually because they fucked up the personal stuff. They became difficult to work with. They couldn't do the basic stuff like be nice, be humble, do what they're told. And because it's not a lack of talent that stopped people from booking work. It's getting caught up in your own shit, man. And like, I'm not, one of the things that has been massively beneficial to me, the thing is, you know this, the truth of the matter is, I'm not arrogant. I do that as this Ricky Gervais parody thing that I like because I find it funny to be a Kanye West. But the truth is that I'm very insecure. I'm very sweet, very humble, and I don't like to say anything to anyone really. And one of the things that has been important to me is that I haven't on iZombie and in the years come I haven't like hung out with yes men. I've identified people who wanted to be mates with me post success or post show. I've seen people who get sucked into that world where they're with people who don't have their best interests at heart.
Sure.
And I've rejected that, and I've kept just a core group, the same group of friends that I've had since I was at elementary school are the same friends I talk to now, and I haven't added to that. I haven't upgraded or sent, you know, now I could be friends with this guy. No, I don't care. These and my support group do not give a shit about anything, and I get called out on everything all the time. If it's a tweet they thought was out, I get a text from my mum. Like, so the people I'm around are constantly making sure that no one gasses me up too much, that your head doesn't get too big. Yeah, the show was good. Yeah, you are getting it. And then there's a little bit of medicine that comes with that and a reality check that, you know, not to get above your station. And I think that that's where a lot of actors, man, and artists, I think they get praised too much. They get put on pedestals and they start becoming
entitled. They can do no wrong, right? And then you try to get criticism, and then I'm sure it's a whole different thing.
Yeah for sure.
You bring it up. I was going to get there on my own, but do you worry? You're talking about, and again, I do know you. You are a great dude. You stuffed poster tubes at our house when you came over and worked out of the spare bedroom. Like, I think that speaks volumes to who you are. Do you worry ever about your Twitter? Because like that's the thing is, like, on Twitter, I love you. You tweet just. I mean, you're my friend Rahul. You're tweeting and you're doing characters occasionally and all this other stuff. But you also do push it a lot. And like, I don't know. In that world, like how much you're talking about, oh, Netflix and Paramount saw my video of me and my outtakes with my mom. They also probably saw me on the shitter then that one time when I put up this photo and did this. Like, is that how you just want to live and let it all cards where they fall?
I don't know.
Fall where they may.
I don't know. It is something I think about. Especially right now, because I think people are... We're getting into like cancel culture and whether it exists or not and all of that stuff. But from my experience, there definitely is a fascination. We are the Twitter and social media became the new reality show where we would watch Big Brother and watch people lose sure. their minds and, you know, mess up and decide whether they were good human beings or not. Right now, it was, you know, Twitter is the most interactive way of entertainment. You could bait a celebrity into saying something terrible or getting under their skin and then watching that unfold. Everyone has this, like, it is its own reality TV show, is social media. And the truth is that the audience has nothing to lose, and all the people that are on there that are promoting their stuff have everything to lose. And I look at the way I've been on Twitter and social media, and it's just been honest. I try never to... I can be scrappy. I definitely can be a hothead. I'm thin-skinned. But for the most part, I just like to make people laugh, and I like having a good time. But I do worry that, personally, I think the reason why I got away with what I got away with, and I haven't had too much of a backlash, and I haven't had people ask me to chill out. None of my bosses, no one's ever said, hey, like... chill out on this and maybe refrain from using this kind of language. Yeah. The reason I haven't is because I don't think anyone cares about me right now. I don't think I'm big enough for it to be a problem. I think the second you see a casting announcement where, you know, I'm part of some sort of franchise, is the second you'll see I get more criticism. Sure. People will dig up old tweets. Pull up Funhouse stuff where I'm obviously doing satire and I'm saying things because that's what we do. You're not your real self. You're mucking around.
Sure.
They'll pull that out. They'll clip that and go, hey, Disney, is this your boy talking about pedophiles? And it has no context. And so I think that really and truly, like, I do worry, but I think the damage is done. And I think
Don't cry. It's going to be okay.
I'm just having my moment. but yeah, I do think that, I think it's in the post.
I think... It's interesting to see your take on it, because I feel like with your Twitter profile in general, it's the fact that it's over time, if that makes sense. Where, yeah, anything any of us have done in my 14 years of professionally podcasting can be broken out, but it's always that thing of how you deal with it. And I think about you on Twitter and your Twitter presence, right, which of course is you, and then there's characters involved or whatever, but I mean, even like calling out the blatant racism you see, or being super into soccer, it's not called football, and like the way you banter about all that, it's banter, and you know that. And I think that like you get in there, and if you read enough of it, you see, oh, this is what it is. But I even mean in that way of like the fact that you will call people out and you will get into it, and like, you know, for better or worse, sometimes or the other, like, I think that's part of it that showcases. And to your point, I think it'd be a different story if you never did that and then did it out of the blue, then it's like a bigger deal. But like when you're getting consistently the same kind of content out of something, I think it's different. And I was trying to find it over here, I couldn't, but somebody in our circles of video games or whatever the other day put it up that I'd never seen before, and I loved it and I retweeted it. But it was every day there's a main character of Twitter, and your goal is to not be it. Because what you're talking about of like,
yeah,
entertainment, like, right, yeah, we all watch The Real World, and oh my god, Puck is such an asshole, right? And every day now there's a different person on Twitter.
Yesterday was Kim Kardashian. She was the main main star of Twitter.
Yeah.
For the posts. Yeah, you don't want to be that. You don't want to be that person. I'm personally talking with family and friends. I'm probably gonna go for good.
Leave Twitter?
Yeah, yeah. That's something that I am gonna do. For sure. I enjoy it. I've changed a lot as well. I'm less confrontational. Sure. So I've had moments where I've had to step away, and I've taken months breaks, and I've gone like, I've had to try and like not get into scraps and get baited out into fighting with people and standing up for like, because it's just I'm just tired, and it does affect me. You say something to me, I reply, I'm the one still left shaking, wanting to punch the wall or get into a scrap, and I can't because it's anonymous people I'm constantly fighting. Yeah. And if I keep pretending, like that's how it feels sometimes for me when I get into it. It feels like Matrix Reloaded. It feels like when Neo's fighting the agents and they're just coming through the floodgates, and it's just overwhelming and it doesn't stop. And each one of those people, it's one interaction, but for me, it's 1v300.
Yeah.
And when it's done, I'm left exhausted, raw, vulnerable. I'm shitty to real people in my life now. Now I'm crapped. I'm not engaging with you on a date.
Yeah.
Or a FaceTime call. You know why? Because I'm fucking pissed off by some anonymous person online. I'm like, this is insane.
You're so preaching the choir, obviously. Like, right? I mean, every internet personality gets it, I think, or whatever. And I think that, you know, I always talk about it with game devs. And back in the day, it was this thing of, you know, when you talk to devs, the slow realization that the hate they get for their game was the same kind of hate I would get for an article. But the thing was, in those days, right, I would publish 5 articles a day. They would publish 1 game every 5 years. And so that resonated so much more loudly. And it's, I think, in a lot of ways similar for you, right? Where, you know, people run into you in this giant sense of blind manner and come to you, and then some are going to come shittily because that's how it is. And again, they're coming at you because in the same way I always, you know, make reference to like when I used to watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians, or when I was hate watching The Office season 9 or whatever. And it would be that thing of like the shit I would say to the TV, I would say to the TV and it would go away. And it wasn't a real thought. I wasn't really motivated. And now people do that into the ecosystem of Twitter, but they send it to you, not realizing that you are a human being on the other side. And yeah,
absolutely.
The amount of times that Jen and I are about to go do something, we're going to go for a walk, and you get that comment that sets you off, and you can't get out of it. And for me, it's like, you know, I've done it where we're on dates, like you're talking about, of like, wrapped a shoot, did this thing, we're in some location or whatever, we're going to go out to a nice dinner. And it's that thing of, I check my phone that one last time, and it's the disaster one of, there's this Reddit thread or a Reset Era thread. And it's like, I got to respond to this, and I can't not. And it's, I have to, but I don't, but I do. Cause now I'm ruined. Like, my head's there. Yeah. My head's no longer in the fun place unless it have our couple time or anything.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, there are certain people who are equipped that I think there are people who are better equipped to deal with it. And the real kind of maturity, like what I'm trying to learn right now is it's not about me adapting and me changing because now I'm all of a sudden my engagement's bigger and my reach is bigger. So I have to change. It's not that I have to change. It's that I have to identify who I am, what upsets me, and protect myself.
Sure.
I don't need to change the way I am because people say shitty things to me. I need to protect myself from shitty things being said to me. So I've learned to mute phrases.
Yep.
I don't even see your shit anymore. If I know I've said something controversial about this the current administration, which you know just invites that crap.
Oh, of course.
If I've called out someone, or if I've tried to stand up for something, or I've mentioned something that is to do with some sort of feminism or the LGBTQ community, that thread gets muted immediately. So I get to say stuff, and then I mute that thread. I never get to hear your opinion on it because I don't care about your opinion on it. It's my opinion. So I've learned ways to protect myself, because the truth of the matter is, if you're out with me and we go for a drink and someone says something shitty to me outside, I know my personality. My personality is one that I will sit there while you're going to me, Rahul, leave it. Leave it. And I'm like, no, I've got to fucking say something. No, I'm going to go up and I'm going to say something. And that's always been me. I am confrontational in that way. I do get into scraps. And it happens so rarely, because in real life, people, there are consequences. So people tend to be on their best behavior in real one-to-one interactions.
Yeah, no. The shit you would post on a review or a YouTube comment or the tweets, right? You would never say to somebody's face.
No, absolutely. So, but the thing is, what I identified with social media was these very rare interactions where I would get fired up and get into a fight in the streets or at a pub or wherever, they're happening every day on Twitter. I'm feeling the same type of fight or flight. Mm. I'm feeling that same type of anxiety, but I've got nowhere to deal with this. I don't know where it goes because someone just said something. And then it just becomes shitty Rahul to my friends and family for a day or at work. And that's where I was like, I think I'm done with provoking as much as I can. Or if I do provoke, because I still can't keep my mouth shut, I'll still provoke and then just I'll just mute. So I don't care what you have to say anymore. I've learned ways to just mute you out. But where work's concerned, the reason my loved ones and my team are concerned is everyone's worried about, like, you know, losing your job over something because you decided to have a hot take on something, and then it just like. It completely can destroy your life.
I keep waiting for these PC gamers to come cancel me anytime, because I'm the only one brave enough to stand up to these RTXs and 3800s and whatnot.
You're going to stand up to me?
I don't want to clown you out. You know what I mean?
I switched to the PC life. But
that's the reason you can't come back to our country. So there you go.
That's true. That is absolutely true. But I kind of felt with Instagram and Twitter, the one that resonated with me most as the reasons to leave was, this might sound, now I'm about to sound arrogant, I think I'm fairly good at what I do as my career, and people are realizing that 7 years after 7-8 years of being on TV, people are going, oh, you're actually a decent actor, like I really like some of your work. And it seems like it's in spite of the impression you gave on Twitter, you actually can act. And that's kind of worrying, because it's like, so my public persona is what? Internet fuckboy who sometimes, you know what I mean? Who sometimes does thing, when really I'm theater actor who's just as well trained as anyone else and has taken their profession seriously. And I carry that professionalism at work, and then I sell myself short on social media. And
well, it's such a, I hear you, and it's like, I understand what you're saying. Totally. I think it's just that idea of there's the difference of, and I, again, knowing you is completely different than just knowing your Twitter or Instagram, but there's that idea of seeing someone in the way that, like, you use social media for the most part as social media, right? And you're clowning around talking about the latest topic. Here's a video game. This is what I'm dressed as a Jedi. Like, and then something like this comes around again, your video game, right? Your video game moment, or something you've been working on quietly for 9 months is finally going out. And I think it's that shift of, oh, right, he does do this. This is who he is. Every day he's clowning about this and he's yelling at Cameron and he's doing that. Like, that's who I see him as, a person, human being, a peer. And then there's this thing of like, oh, right, I couldn't do that. I don't know how. There's this different side to it. Whereas like mine is like every day I'm using social media share to joke around and bag on PCs and eat Oreos. But I'm also putting up a million different kind of funny videos. Like, you understand that the work and me are intrinsically tied. Whereas they are for you too, but you don't, how do you present that? How do you present something when you're filming it?
Well, I think that my work and me should not be entwined. They should be separate. And I think, and I'm wising up to it, and I hope it's not too late. The more you know about me, the worse it is for my characters. I saw tweets where people like, can't believe that this is the same guy from those Funhouse videos. And I ask myself, well, hold on a second. So what were you thinking when you were watching? How much, because you think you know me. And how much of me, like, are you buying this work? Is it harder to invest in the characters I'm playing because I have such a clear personality on social media? How much have I exposed too much of myself? If I play a tough guy or a villain, how much more do I have to do to undo the last tweet about my anus? You know what I mean? Like, and that's the issue, and that's the biggest argument. It's not canceling. It's not that 5 years ago I said something that's aged and I don't believe anymore or whatever. It's not that is the reason to leave. The reason to leave is we want you to play this character, but you have too much of a presence, and they can't separate it, and they're not, and then it goes back to the original point. I'm there to serve the story, not myself. Social media serves me. And at the same time, I think it's a disservice to the story, because you should be able to see me, take me as that character immediately, and not be able to identify Rahul from this guy. And so that's my biggest argument, is right now, I'm not at the point of my career. Social media helps in terms of presence and engagement, and I get producers and directors and people reaching out to me, and I'm on their radar to a certain degree, because I'm not the first name that pops into your head when you think of casting someone. The race I am is not the first thing that pops into your head when you cast someone. So I do have to have this, I'm playing this game right now where I do have to be in your face and remind you that I'm out there, and I do look I can look like Joel from The Last of Us. You don't have to go straight for Jeffrey Dean Morgan. Not that I ever would, I'm not the right casting for it, but the point being, I have to sort of advertise myself enough, and then at some point, what I'm hoping is there's a point where the advertising can stop, and the calls come based on the work. And once that's happening, I'm out. Once I know that I can pull away from that advertising world and allow the people on Netflix's side or Hulu or whoever I'm working with to do the promoting for me, I'm out. Instagram gets deactivated, Twitter gets deactivated. People can have the small little group that are used to me will know, oh yeah, he used to say stupid shit and he's funny and here's some Funhouse videos, or here's him on a podcast, or here's someone kind of funny. But out on the bigger side of that, they won't know who I am. And I think that that's probably what I want, because I just think it's serving the story better, and I come with less baggage.
Dude, this got intense. You know what I mean? Wow. I mean, you took me places, as you always do. You know what I mean? If you want to quit, like, it's like, just don't quit until after this video goes live so you can tweet it.
I was thinking about tonight.
If you want, we can do the thumbnail. You know, we have cool friends. Rahul Kohli quits Twitter. And then you can just put that up as your final tweet, and bam, there you go.
Oh, then now you got the exclusive.
I know, right? Then Entertainment Tonight comes to me. John Tesh is calling me. Like, what was it like to hear him say that? I was like, it was fucked up.
I doubt it. There'll be one Reddit forum that were like, did you hear Raul left? And I'll be like, he'll be back. He always says
that. he can't quit us. Look at him try.
He's addicted to it. But yeah, I it's not a matter of if, it's when
for me. I it makes sense, like the case you lay out, right? Of like, yeah, like the reactions of people who think they know you for one thing, seeing you actually do your profession. And they'd be like, oh man, he's actually good. Like, wait, what? You thought I was going to be terrible? You thought I wouldn't be that? You thought I couldn't do that?
And it's not their fault.
No.
It's entirely my fault. And that's why a lot of actors, like, you don't know, Joaquin Phoenix isn't on Twitter. The second Joaquin Phoenix is on Twitter talking about bidets, or he paints model kit and he becomes relatable, is the second that you watch The Joker and you go, he's acting, and you don't want that. That's not what you want, right? And so yeah, I've got to disappear soon. I think we'll see. Like I said, it depends on the level of work. If I'm at the level that I'm at right now, I'm okay with it. But if it ever got a little bit more intense, or I was working on things that were being seen on a mass scale,
sure,
I'm out. Huh. Or it's hand over the keys to a publicist.
And that I'd love to see. I'd love to see your publicist.
You'll know the minute you'll know the minute it's not me.
Hello, everyone. It's me, Rahul. I'm here to talk to you about my miniatures.
Exactly.
I have questions for you from patreon.com/kindoffunny in the friend zone. But before we do that, let me tell you about our sponsors. This episode of We Have Cool Friends is brought to you by MeUndies. Hi, friends. MeUndies believes your comfort is about more than what's touching your skin. It's about feeling comfortable in your skin. You're a total badass, and what you wear should only accentuate that fact. MeUndies truly believes in empowering self-expression. Their pledge for 2020 and beyond is called MeUndies Gives, an initiative that supports those who have systemic barriers to their self-expression. By shopping MeUndies, you support causes such as the LGBTQ+ communities, mental health and well-being, as well as women's rights. Ladies and gentlemen, of course, this is fantastic and truly in line with what Kinda Funny believes, but we also believe in MeUndies because I've been wearing MeUndies forever, if you didn't know. Of course, I tried some a long time ago, liked them so much, I threw away the rest of my underwear and bought a bunch more MeUndies. They're super soft. They get delivered right to your door. You can have an undies subscription so you never have to worry about, hey, man, do I need new underwear? What, you're always getting new underwear. And plus, they do crazy patterns and fun stuff all the time. There's a million different reasons you can do it, but why not look into one of those memberships? Of course, MeUndies believes you and your butt deserve comfort inside and out, which is why they created the Undies membership. It's a great way to love yourself. Each month, replenish your basics with styles that are anything but basic. Styles let you be the truest version of yourself right down to your core. Plus, members enjoy discounted pricing, controlled shipping, and early exclusive access. Love your butt and get the membership. MeUndies has a great offer for my listeners. For any first-time purchasers, you get 15% off and free shipping. MeUndies also has their problem-free philosophy. If you're not satisfied with your product for any reason, they'll refund or exchange it. No caveats, no questions. To get your 15% off your first order and free shipping, go to MeUndies.com/morning. That's MeUndies.com/morning. Our next sponsor is Blue Chew. Let's talk about something we all could use more of right now. Sex. Great sex. Guys, right now you can increase your performance and get the extra confidence in bed by going to bluechew.com. That's blue like the color blue. Blue Chew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach, so you can be ready whenever the opportunity arises. Blue Chew is made in the USA. It's prescribed online by licensed physicians, so you don't have to go to the doctor or wait in line. It's even cheaper than a pharmacy, and they prepare and ship right to you in a discreet package. No awkwardness, and you don't need to leave the house. One of Tim's friends has been using this. He was just talking about it on the other show we do called In Review, if you didn't wonder why I was like this. It's been easy. It's been great. It's been discreet. It's been what that person is looking for. And if you're looking for something similar to this, why not try Blue Chew? If you could benefit from more confidence where it counts, Blue Chew is fast and easy, and it's the way to enhance your performance. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use the special offer code FUNNY and pay just $5 in shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code FUNNY to try it for free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper choice, and we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you help make this podcast possible. So please be sure to use the promo code FUNNY at bluechew.com. Okay, you're entering the friend zone now, where the Kinda Funny best friends write into patreon.com/kindoffunny and ask you questions. Let's start with this one right here. At Got Sing writes in and says, given the restricted state of the world now, is there any viable way for someone new to try and become a working actor?
That's a tough one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you just have to speak for your entire industry and profession. It's not that bad.
Yeah. And I have to crush someone's dreams. Do I think, right now, take for what you are, I think actors who were employed consistently pre-pandemic are struggling to get work. Mm-hmm. There's less being made right now. They don't really know where. It's too early to call. And also, I assume that if Harrison Ford's schedule has opened up because his productions have torpedoed because of the pandemic and now he's available for Riverdale, it's going to be a lot tougher for someone who isn't Harrison Ford to be. That was what I was worried about. I mean, I'm worried at my level. I was like, well, you know, what if Dev Patel and Riz Ahmed are now available when they weren't? When usually we'd know they're locked because they're constantly working. I eat their scraps. If their stuff's been shut down, there's no scraps for me to eat. So if you're just breaking in, I think it's a terrible time. But I could be wrong because you could be incredible in your audition and it will always come back to the work. So just screw that. Just do the best audition you can possibly do because that will always override everything.
Okay. Brandon Follow Wrightson. Follow your dreams.
Follow your dreams.
Ignore everything and push through. Brandon writes in, it says, first off, I want to say thank you, Rahul, for being an image and model that people can look up to. Being brown and growing up in a predominantly non-brown area led me to a lot of insecurity as a child. As someone who aspires to have a career in the industry, I'm thankful that people who look like us will have a positive representation in you. My question for you is, what are some of your favorite actor performances of all time and how have they inspired you? P.S. You don't get nearly enough credit for how good you were in iZombie.
Wow, there's a lot to process there. the representation stuff always kills me because I very much grew up in that environment and I am or was a self-loathing Indian. I hated being Indian. I hated my name. I hated my skin color. And I unfortunately think that some of my success is due to the fact that it's my hatred and my willingness to try and put that aside and fit in is what sent me to the arts rather because I was like, no, I don't want to be a doctor or a lawyer. That's too stereotypical. Mm. So there's this weird, I have this weird relationship with my heritage. And funnily enough, if they think that I've done them some good in representation, the truth of the matter is that they've actually helped me more than I've helped them because seeing, being visible and being told by people who look like me that I somehow mean something to them and give them hope has made me get over all of this self-loathing, assimilating crap that I used to do back in the day to survive. And now I embrace being brown, being Indian. So it's actually, they're doing me a favor. I have a much more balanced and accepting sense of myself and my culture because of people like him. So I appreciate him more. So thank you for that. You've helped me be proud of who I am. Where the performances are concerned, things that inspired me. Sylvester Stallone was a big part growing up. Harrison Ford was another one that I, Star Wars plays the biggest role in any type of inspiration I have, which you know about, which is I talk to death about, but
you love that. I love that Star Wars and comedy.
Bill Murray, Ghostbusters was my favorite comedy as a kid. My dad was like force feeding us comedy all the time. Fawlty Towers, John Cleese, Ricky Gervais, Dave Chappelle, Richard Pryor. Like I had a really good comedy education as a kid and I think that played hugely into why I booked iZombie and was able to do that.
Okay. Hell yeah. Let's stick on this acting train. Wesley LeBlanc writes in to patreon.com/kindoffunny, just like you can. It says, so Haunting of being an anthology show saw many Hill House cast members return to Bly. You, however, were a newcomer. What was it like becoming a part of that awesome cast? Also, at what point did you realize in filming that Owen was the best character? Because, wow, you crushed it, man. We've talked about Bly, and we talked about you coming and getting into character. Yeah, was there a bit of, like, it's their sophomore year, it's your freshman year, or was it everybody's ready to go?
I think it was weird for me because everything I've done, like with iZombie, we wasn't tried and tested, and none of us knew what to expect. But with Hill House and with working with Victoria and Ollie and Henry and Carla, like they already knew what to expect. So you had people who were like, if you wanted to, you can ask them about their experience and how to navigate this. And they kept saying, "Oh, get ready for how huge this is going to be. get ready for like the crazy freaking shitstorm and whirlwind this is going to be when it comes out. They didn't know COVID was going to happen and that we would just do Zoom press talks because it's good. But their experience is still completely like there was nothing to bend like that. All of that kind of experience I got from them and hearing about how crazy the intense the haunting fans can be just didn't play out anyway. But yeah, I didn't feel like I was a sophomore or anything. Like I had just got off 5 years of working in Vancouver. So weirdly, I just felt normal. I wasn't intimidated. I was like, out of all the actors on the show, I'd just come off the most amount of work. I'd just done like 75 eps straight up. So I was still in that kind of like, let's go mode. I hit the ground running with them. I never once thought that Owen was the best character. I still don't think he's the best character. I think when people say that, I think they're being very sweet. But to me, it's like, wow, there were people on that show like Tania and Amelia Eve, who worked their ass off all 6 months while I fucked around and played Switch and watched Liverpool. And only had to come in a couple of times a week. And then when people say that, I'm like, such a disservice to the amount of work that those other people put in. So I reject that.
Okay. Well, you talked about how, of course, you know, your family and friends take you down the peg when you need to be taken down a peg. Kate writes in with the final question, and she's going to do that for us. All right. Something I noticed, too. I didn't want to bring it up, but she's bringing it up for us. Hi, Rahul. So I was watching Bly Manor when it dropped earlier this month, and I noticed something fishy in the second episode. In the second episode, starting around the 3 minute 31 second mark, Owen does something quite astonishing that shocked both me and my boyfriend. If you want to play a little game, go ahead and watch if you can see and pick out what we saw. But basically what happens is ... Owen straight up grabs a sizzling hot cast iron skillet with his bare hand and takes it like a motherfucking champ. You mind explaining how Owen developed this particular set of culinary skills? Love you in the show. Can't wait to see more stuff.
I did.
You fucking hack.
I know, right? I mean? And you're a chef.
Jen and I both saw it. We both saw it. We're like, oh, disgusting.
Do you want the truth?
Yeah.
It was on. That's a working stove. That kitchen was working.
You're a liar.
That was cooking sausages all day. It just wasn't hot. If it was, I would have grabbed a towel. I don't know why. When I did that, they were cooking for real, and that pan had been there the whole time. I grabbed it. I barely felt any heat, so I was like, oh. And I decided that maybe he has like, you know, he's a chef, so he's used to intense heat.
He's got the calloused hands.
He's got the calloused hands. So the truth of the matter is, it's not like it was off. That stove was cold and, you know, I didn't think and I just did it. I was like, we'd been cooking with it. I've been sitting there cooking these sausages for real. And the pan just wasn't hot enough. So I was like, oh, I don't know. I didn't think my acting might have distracted from the pan, but it turns out it wasn't.
Well, the other thing too is, you know, I live with a Brit, Lucy James from GameSpot.com. At some point pointed out on Twitter too. Well, she not anymore because she pointed out at some point too, bangers and mash, not a lunchtime meal. That's what she said.
Lucy, who I love to death, is insulting my show.
I know. It's fucked up to see Lucy James from GameSpot ruin Bly Manor like that for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lucy, I'm sending that to Mike. Yeah, look at you can take it from here, Lucy. You can finish the show, but I'm just saying, like, I brought up the bangers and mash thing.
Is it the bangers and mash? All right, come on, Lucy.
Do I get to confront you? EYA.
Yeah.
How are you? You're right.
I'm good. How you doing?
Doing all right.
I missed that. What's happened with the bangers and mash? What's your problem? Insult my show.
Gravy. There was no gravy.
Wasn't there?
Uh-uh.
Oh. I have no defense. There was no gravy. I hate gravy. So what? I wouldn't have noticed. Yeah, I'll you know bangers and mash. I have it with ketchup.
Mate.
So in my head, yeah. So when they did it, I wasn't like, sorry. Like if they had done it, if it was a Sunday roast, I'll lather up on that or a toad in the hole. But for that bangers and mash, no, I have ketchup, so I didn't even notice that we didn't have.
Oh my God, I am learning a lot.
There was some weird stuff. We had shepherd's pie.
Yeah.
With lettuce and fries.
What?
Look for that. Yeah.
That's
the biggest offense of Bly Manor.
Has there been a Twitter campaign about that one yet?
I've seen it come up. People have noticed. I just didn't want to draw attention to it. But shepherd's pie with chips.
That's no. A shepherd's pie is a full meal.
Yeah.
You've already got the potato. Why do you need another?
Yeah. Why do you need the extra potato?
That's
terrible show. And that's why I think we deserve a lower Rotten Tomato score.
No, you're fine. That was a good show.
Anyway, oh, thanks.
I'll let Greg get back.
Good to see you, Lisa. I'm good.
Yeah, you too. Hopefully see you soon.
Bye. Likewise. See you.
Okay, she slipped into full British. She slipped into full British there.
You proved your point. Yeah, the show sucked. Where
so, you know, somebody had to say it. Maybe you can fix it in the next one. Murder House.
You have to bring it. You have to, I could have just been the Brit on it between you and me and told you that that was the way it was, but you had to bring a Brit here to confirm.
Somebody's got
to
keep you honest. You know what I mean?
That's fair. I respect it. I wasn't expecting that. I'm going to do a Trump now and be like, no, you're asking tough questions. You're asking me about...
it was very disrespectful.
Are we done? Are we done?
I saw Jack Quaid on this show. You didn't ask him tough questions. Rahul, thank you for being one of our cool friends.
Oh, thank you for being my friend.
We're very proud.
I didn't say cool.
It's fair. You know other people. It's cool. You know.
No, you're one of the coolest, Greg.
No, don't even. It's too late. Awesome. Where can people keep up with you until you delete all your social media?
My name, Roel Coley 13. Also, just reactivated that Twitch account.
Oh, we're about to get some more streams in there?
Yeah, because I'm here. I'm on my own and I can't leave the apartment, right? Because of the bubble.
Sure.
So sure. I got a couple of Lego kits and I was like, well, shit, why don't I just stream while I build some Lego and keep myself entertained? So I'll be popping on there now and again.
Sure. You ever going to play games on there again? Because I mean, like, you know, PCs are so easy to transport and stream with. I'm sure you brought up your monitor and your keyboard and your mouse, your giant tower. It's probably all right there with you, right?
Yeah. What's your point, Greg? I had a laptop, so it's working off that. But yeah.
Okay. Well, we keep looking for you on Twitch then.
Just say in it for me one. Get it right.
In it.
Yeah.
You done it. Now, honestly, since we had the confrontation during the Let's Play, I fixed it. In it.
I appreciate that.
In it, yeah, you know what I mean.
I don't know how you were doing
that. Nah, Greg, you're doing something weird there. That was my favorite part of the clip. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been We Have Cool Friends. Remember, each and every week we get a cool friend to talk to about the cool things they're doing. Next week it is David Krause from stackup.org. You, of course, can go to patreon.com/kindoffunny to ask questions there. You can get the show ad free. You can contribute. You can do all sorts of cool stuff. If you want to wait till later, youtube.com/kindoffunny and podcast services around the globe, usually every Tuesday. Ladies and gentlemen, until next time, it's been our pleasure to serve you.